It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a doctor tells us what he learned when he asked patients to tell him about their money troubles and how that can affect their health. First, while not the only one struggling, many young adults have reportedly felt like they fell behind in life in 2020. And the years where they're supposed to be, in quotes, pursuing careers, marriage, learning more about themselves, adventuring, things have become slow going. For many who've lost jobs or moved back in with parents, it's even felt like backtracking. Our next guest says that while this feeling was intensified for many during the pandemic, our fantasy of young adulthood accomplishments and checkboxes doesn't match up with reality, even in normal times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a young person, maybe in high school, in your 20s, what has your pandemic time been like? Have you felt anxious or worried about the progress you've been making or unable to make in this last year? Was there a milestone you'd hope to hit in 2020 that had to get postponed, and for how far? If you're older, do you look back and think your expectations about young adulthood were too ambitious? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rainsford Stauffer is a writer. Her forthcoming book about young adulthood is called An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. She wrote the piece, 2020 Felt Like a Wasted Year for Many Young Adults, for Vox. Rainsford, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
Well, before we dig into 2020, you've been thinking a lot about how we think about our 20-something era. What are some of the popular things you see in the media, maybe in our pop culture, that are supposed to be, in quotes, in our 20s?
Absolutely. I think this is such a fascinating question because it's one of those things where the pressure seems to be coming from all sides. We have these very specific media tropes, everything from sitcoms to buddy comedies that sort of idealize young adulthood as this time where you're venturing off on a backpacking trip or an adventure, or you found the love of your life, or you've moved in with a great roommate in a new city, or you've gotten a new job. And then we've got kind of the more academic, societal workforce pressure where you're expected to go to college and know what you major in from the get-go, know what job that gets you on the back end, and kind of transition right into adulthood without ever second-guessing the path you're on, experiencing things that we call setbacks, but are often just kind of the reality of life, that everything kind of ebbs and flows and doesn't always stay on the straight and narrow trajectory. And it's almost like we've divided our ideas of young adulthood into these two bubbles. You're either adventurous and you're having fun all the time, and you have no responsibilities, which we know isn't entirely realistic, or you have everything figured out. You're never going to make a mistake. You're never going to fall off this certain path. And if you have, you failed, which obviously doesn't match up with our reality now, but didn't before the pandemic either.
And a point you raise in the piece in Vox, Rainsford, is that for a big chunk of the population, their economic background, their means don't fit into either of those as a reality. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. I think that sometimes when we talk about young adults or when we use the term millennials, and I think it's important to note that some millennials are approaching 40 if they're not there already, and that that's just, you know, the name of a generation of birth years, not young adults. I think we think of young adults as people who are hanging out on TikTok, most of whom are still in college and kind of have no responsibilities at all. And what you find when you speak to young people is that even for those who are students who do love TikTok, that's not the case. Lots of young people are already caretakers or parents. Lots of them have been working jobs since they were teenagers to support themselves or their families. And all of them, to some extent, are trying to find their way and kind of carve out a path for themselves in their lives where they can take care of each other, take care of their families, and find something fulfilling along the way.
And now that brings us to this pandemic year we just had or still having. Really, how do you see that impacting 20-somethings or people just hitting their 20s, maybe already feeling like they weren't hitting these already unrealistic expectations?
Absolutely. So what we know about this year is it stalled a lot of these external markers that we kind of societally consider part of growing up and living your best life as a young adult. And that could look like anything from a postponed graduation or wedding or a job offer being rescinded because of economic strains related to COVID. It could look like this idea that we're supposed to be traveling and hanging out with friends and all of these things that it's not to say we weren't doing them. It's just that that probably wasn't the whole story for everyone. Now, statistically, we know that young people ages 18 to 29 are moving back in with their parents at record rates. And that's something that's often kind of spun as a moral failing, like you didn't do enough or have enough in your savings account to make it on your own. But that ignores a lot of cultural implications or facets of someone's family life or their role as a caretaker that might just make it better for them to be in a more community-centered environment with their family, with other people. We saw college students booted from campuses and losing jobs and in some cases losing housing. And we know that the pandemic is set to postpone key life events even further if one chooses to do them at all. And I think that there's a pretty stark contrast between the life decisions that young people are trying to make now and even what it looked like a year ago, because now we're starting to look twice at some of these things and think, wait, was this ever entirely realistic?
We're talking to Rainsford Stauffer. Her upcoming book is called An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. We're talking about 2020, the pandemic, and how it may have disrupted some of those milestones young adults were hitting, expecting to hit, hoping to hit, and maybe why some of those weren't realistic, even in normal times. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Emmy is with us in Oshkosh. Emmy, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Emmy?
Well, I just wanted to mention I'm a 22-year-old, and I was going to purchase a home in 2019. And unfortunately, because of the pandemic, I wasn't able to. It had such an effect on the home buying market that prices they skyrocketed in my area. And so I was all set to buy a home, and then I had to do what a lot of my peers have had to do, which is move back in with my parents instead of becoming a homeowner.
How is that going, Emmy, if I may ask, living with your parents now?
It went about how you would expect living with your parents when you're an adult. I did get the opportunity to rent an apartment, but now, of course, I've got to put the home buying dream on hold for maybe another year or two.
All right. Well, Emmy, thank you so much for sharing your story and starting us off, and good luck with the home situation. Rachel, right there, one of the young adults you were talking about had not planned on moving in with her parents. Here she is hoping somewhere down the road she can get back into that home buying mode.
Absolutely. And I think that that's such an important point for a variety of different reasons. And I think maybe the biggest one is something that tends to get overlooked in how we talk about generations, which is that, you know, no one expects to have these things that we often think of as setbacks. I think whether they are actually setbacks or not is kind of open to interpretation of the individual person and their circumstances. But nobody thinks, well, I'm going to have to drain my savings account. I busted it to earn for a medical bill. I'm not going to have to move back in with my parents. We don't really talk about these things when we talk about young adulthood. And I think that's why this myth that if these things happen to you, you failed, remains so persistent.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Alex now in Prairie du Chien. Alex, hello.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to share my story. When I was in my early 20s, I got my dream job, got out of college right about 6 months before the economy collapsed. And I had to move back home with my parents, and my unemployment barely covered my student loan payment. Real dark time for me. But obviously, you know, we got out of that. And when I got another job, I vowed never to have a kind of a big issue like that have so much control over me and my destiny. So I made savings and stability my priority just to be prepared. And when the pandemic came around, I had a substantial emergency fund. So I lost my job again. But in this respect, my lifestyle barely changed from saving and living below my means. So thank you.
Alex, thanks a lot. I hope you have gotten your job back or are getting your job back soon. Good luck to you. Alex, in that category range sort of people who got hit by the Great Recession just as they were entering the workforce, things settled down. Alex feels like he was ready this time around, but that double whammy for a lot of people of just that wrong age, I guess, in this case.
Absolutely. And I think that's really common, especially with millennials, people who are in their, you know, their later 20s, their 30s, in some cases, maybe even their 40s. There was one recession. And in some cases, it feels like we never entirely exited that recession. And I think that one of the things that's really important to know is that the pressures that are commonly aligned with, quote unquote, being young can't be divorced from things like race and class and socioeconomics. And in thinking about this, I was reading a survey of more than 38,000 students who had responded to this survey during the pandemic, and 58% were experiencing basic needs insecurity. They didn't know where their next meal was coming from. They were experiencing housing insecurity. And so I think that we're seeing time and time again that these things have real ramifications on mental and physical health and how people make their way in the world.
Thanks a lot for that call, Alex. We're talking to Rainsford Stauffer. She's the author of the upcoming book, An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. She wrote a piece on young adulthood during the pandemic for Vox. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a younger person yourself, a young adult, or just getting there or just out of that stage, has the pandemic made you change your perspective, your plans, and your life somehow? Did it affect your work life? Did you have to postpone a milestone you're expecting to hit, a home purchase, a big move, a wedding, you name it? Tell us your story. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rainsford Stauffer, talking about her piece on Vox about young adults feeling like 2020 was a lost year in many ways for them, and about our misconceptions, our misplaced expectations for what young adulthood is supposed to look like, what it really looks like for people in their 20s-ish. You could join in if that's you at 800-642-1234, or maybe your kids, 800-642-1234. How did the pandemic affect the milestones you had hoped to hit, you thought you were going to hit maybe last year? Let's go back to your calls. Eli is with us in La Crosse. Eli, hello.
Hi. I just want to say, I'm a lot better off than a lot of other kids my age. Like, I'm 21. I went to trade school and learned how to weld. And I'm lucky enough that my employer has not had to lay me off for a lot. Like, we've been laid off for about a month and a half total for the year. But that's a lot better than a lot of other businesses right now. And if I had lost my job, I definitely would have had to move back to my parents, which would not have been great.
Gotcha. Eli, thank you so much for sharing that story. And, you know, when we talk about pop culture stories of people in their young adulthood, Rainsford, we don't often see the story of the kid who went to trade school, got a job in welding, that kind of thing. That's one of those scripts that isn't out there in pop culture, but in real life, it can work out pretty well.
Totally. I think that there's such a narrow presentation of young adulthood where every young person graduates college at 18. They're supported by their family. They go to a four-year college. They graduate and they immediately get a job. And what we know is statistically, that's just not the case anymore. Lots of students who do go to four-year universities do not graduate in 4 years. And that should not be an issue. That's one of the reasons that we've got to rethink the entire student debt crisis and make college free, or at least more affordable, because we need to create those opportunities that staying an extra couple years at school or taking one class at a time because you're working isn't an end of days scenario. Just like we have to invest and amplify narratives of young people taking other paths, whether that's a trade or vocational school, whether that's them working for their family business, whether that's caregiving, we need to amplify that as a form of labor that deserves compensation. There are so many different pathways to a successful, fulfilled life. And one of the things that inspires me most about the young people I talk to is that they're so open about rethinking these social structures and scripts that kind of give this very narrow perception of what this time of life ought to be like. Because I think what we're seeing is that it can be so many things for so many different people impacted by so many different circumstances.
Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Eli, at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to Reggie with us in Oshkosh. Reggie, hello.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you want to tell us about Reggie?
So when I was, you know, a young teenager, I was homeless. I was raised by some horrible parents. And in my 20s, it was just a fight to work and go through all these different jobs to find something to sustain myself and then a small family. And, you know, a lot of people have these expectations that, you know, your 20s is just, you know, having fun and living life, when in reality, you should be setting yourself up for later in life so you can have fun later when you're old. You know, I advise all the 20-year-olds, open a 401k, get money put away so that when stuff like this happens, you can stay afloat.
Reggie, thank you so much for sharing your story. And that's, again, Rainsford, somebody who doesn't follow that script, but is definitely out more represented in reality, homelessness, just trying to get by in his 20s.
Definitely. And you know, one of the things it made me think of is this kind of idealization we do in America all the time in particular, because it's a very ageist society. And we can see that in the lack of consideration for elderly people that's been underscored time and time again during the pandemic. But part of this youth-centric pressure, this idea that we're going to have it all figured out by 30, is kind of depressing, because first of all, it means, well, we're never going to have fun later when we're older. And number two, it kind of puts you in this live in the now, do everything you need to do right this second. And if you don't, you failed or you're behind mentality that just doesn't line up with the lives a lot of us are leading. In reality, I think it's possible to be a young person who does have fun and enjoy their young adulthood while also thinking about the kind of future they want to have, the kind of society they want to live in.
Thanks a lot again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Rainsford Stauffer. She's got a book coming out called An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. She wrote a piece for Vox on 20-somethings, how 2020 was a lost year in many ways for them, and also the misleading expectations we have about what young adult life might look like. We heard from Elizabeth in Madeleine Island. She called in to say she's a parent. She said everything in young people's lives were going great in so many ways. COVID was the first time for many, they experienced any kind of hardship. And Rainsford, in some ways, I mean, we haven't had anything like this disease in 100 years. So this was a new novel experience for people of this generation and maybe a generation or two before them.
I think it's certainly a new experience for everyone. And I think that it depends a lot on the individual and their circumstances. But statistically, this isn't the first time that a lot of young people have experienced hardship. You know, things like housing insecurity, basic needs insecurity, homelessness, trying to be a caretaker for an aging parent or their own child, mental health, all of these things we know were impacting young people before the pandemic. And I think what's happened is it's taken them and amplified a lot of these issues. You know, Black and brown young adults are feeling the pandemic's impacts the most. And we know that in terms of unemployment and underemployment, Black and brown young people are more likely to have experienced unemployment during the pandemic compared to young white people. We know that young people are experiencing increased levels of anxiety and depression, depending on the study you read. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that the pandemic definitely amplified some of these things. But in a lot of cases, for a lot of people, it's not the root cause.
Now, we've gotten some great stories from our callers. You also, for this piece, Rainsford, talked to a lot of people about how they were coping coming out of 2020. One interesting response I saw, I think one young woman you talked to said, "Hey, I just realized life's too short. I got married." Talk about that story a little.
Yes, what an incredible story. This woman is incredibly accomplished. She'd worked on 3 political campaigns, ended up losing several relatives to COVID-19, and decided that especially as a Black woman in a time where women, Black women, are being killed in their own homes by police, decided to, as she put it, embrace joy and said that she'd had a lot of joy in her life this year because life was just kind of too short to not really seize those moments when you can grab hold of them. And I felt that that was a really powerful example of being able to look at your own life and certainly not ignore the hardships. There are very real social issues that are impacting every single one of us right now, Black and brown young adults most especially, but being able to look at those issues and still think, I'm going to choose joy where I can. I don't think that ignores that there are major issues facing our society right now that have to be rectified for us to all live our quote unquote best lives. But I was really inspired by the idea that someone decided to seize happiness where they could find it.
Time for one more call. Chelsea is with us in Madison. Chelsea, hi.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to talk about my experience this year, and I had previous to this a pretty stable, well-paying job, but I just wasn't happy with it. And in February, I decided to quit and kind of follow my dreams and took a job in event management, which has been just, a comically horrible timing. And so now I'm kind of stuck in a place where I've obviously where I'm at isn't working, and I don't really want to go back to where I was before. And there is definitely that deadline of I'm reaching the end of my 20s.
Wow, Chelsea, thank you. Well, talk about moments and bad timing, a hard-hit sector of the economy, Rainsford. What do you think, hearing Chelsea's story?
I think that echoes so many stories I've heard from young people, and in some instances have experienced myself over the last couple years, where even your best laid plans and those moments that you decide to really go for it, which is what we tell young people to do. We kind of act as though, economics or circumstances or any of these things, you can overcome all of that if you just work hard enough and really go for your dreams. And that's obviously never been the case. It's never been reality for a lot of young people. But I think we're seeing now why it's so important for us to have a social safety net in place and really focus on overall well-being, not just of young people, but of people in general, because we can have the best laid plans and the most closely held dreams and still encounter circumstances where following those paths just isn't realistic through no fault of our own.
Well, Chelsea, good luck to you. I look forward to attending many events. I don't really care what they are in the hopefully not too distant future. And Rainsford, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the amazing callers that shared such interesting stories.
They did. Thank you. Thank you for calling in. Rainsford Stauffer is a writer. Her forthcoming book about young adulthood is called An Ordinary Age, Finding Your Way in a World That Expects Exceptional. She wrote a piece in Vox about young adults, how they're dealing with the pandemic, and why our expectations about young adulthood don't always match up with reality. We've got a link to her piece, by the way, at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we talk about money with a doctor who spent a lot of time talking about money with his patients. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Tonight at 6, it's a special edition of On Point. On Point brings you the latest on the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol and tries to help make sense of it. And you can join in now. Leave a message for our friends at On Point at 617-353-0683. Again, you can call and leave a message for On Point, 617-353-0683. Then join On Point tonight at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, money might not be a topic you'd expect patients to regularly talk about with their doctor. But for Dr. Michael Stein, he's made a point of asking people he treats about their finances, including whether and how they can afford medications he might prescribe for them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the cost of health care, about the link between poverty and individual health? Have you had to make a tough financial decision about whether you could afford a copay, a procedure, a medication that was important to your well-being? On the other side, if you work in healthcare, do you worry about the financial well-being of your patients? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Michael Stein is a primary care physician and professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at Boston University's School of Public Health. His new book is called Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. Dr. Stein, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, what led you as a doctor, you know, dealing with patients every day, to start bringing up the issue of their money and financial well-being?
Yeah, well, I'm a primary care doctor in the same town for about 30 years, and you get to know people pretty well over that period of time. And even before you know them well, they usually bring up the topic of money in one way or another in my office. And what I decided to do in Broke is to put those voices of the people that I care for down on paper, because I think it's an unusual set of things that people talk about, and I want to change our impression of the lives of people who have low incomes.
And we'll dig into some of those stories in just a bit. You share a lot of them in here, anecdotes from the lives of the people you've worked with. Who are you hoping sees this and learns from it?
Well, I think that poverty is really a solvable problem, right? We can come up with policies at the macro level to address poverty if we want to. We have a sort of shocking numbers in this country when you spend a minute to look at some of our numbers. And the easiest one to make sense of it would be the poverty of children. And this is really even before COVID, when 1 in 6 children lived in poverty. And you have to understand, 1 in 6 is a rate that's absolutely unique among our peer nations. And it really is a choice. It's a political choice. It's our politicians' choice. And there are ways that we can solve much of this if we want to. And I'm hoping that people who might read this book and think about their neighbors will address some of these issues through their voting.
We've seen statistics over the years showing that poverty in and of itself is a health hazard, and that really speaks through the voices of the patients you talk to. Can you talk about some of the ways that people might not think about, if they haven't experienced poverty, some of the ways that poverty hurts people, that it makes them sick in the short and long run?
Well, I'll give you the clearest statistic that I know of. And when I heard of it, I was shocked. And I have to say that now, years later, I remain shocked. The clearest statistic about how health and wealth are related in the United States. When you take people who are living in the poorest county in the United States, so that's in South Dakota, where the median family income is about $26,000, a kid born in that community has a life expectancy of about 67 years. So move across the country now to one of the richest counties. Let's say pick one in Virginia. They have a bunch of rich counties. If you a kid born in that county in Virginia today, your life expectancy is about 84 years, 67 versus 84. So just depending on where you were born and the conditions of your life in that area, there is a 17-year difference. And that is just a shocking demonstration of how wealth affects our health in the most bald form, right? There are lots of other ways that health affects health, and some of the patients in Broke will talk about that. But you can imagine what they are, whether it's going to an emergency room late because you don't want to pay, it's whether it's not filling a full prescription because you're unable to pay, et cetera. So there are many ways and many statistics to bring out that say, you know, it's not good for your health to have not enough money in the United States.
You have a lot of individual stories from patients, and again, their identities are protected. You don't give their real names, but there is a recurring patient who you call Perry in the book. This is somebody clearly you've worked with over a long period of time and gotten to know him pretty well and seen struggles and some of the upsides. How is it for you as a doctor just to see over time how poverty is affecting the patients you work with and get to know pretty well?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up Perry. So, you know, we've been talking about policy and statistics so far, but of course, as you know, the book is really in patient voices. It's 100 or 150 patients just speaking about how money affects their lives, right? The cost of funerals, alimony payments, utility bills, car breakdowns. And I think the reason I started this book was this patient that I've called Perry, who came in one day, is a guy who I knew for several years at that point. And he came in and he said to me, "Doc," he said, "you know, I am so broke that I have to rinse my paper plates." And that was such an interesting and appalling image to me, rinsing off paper plates. And I said, well, you know, tell me about that. What do you spend your money on that you're using paper plates and rinsing them? And Perry then, and it really is the first vignette in this book, tells me about his money, right? He says, I make $720 in Social Security a month and $150 of it in food stamps. My rent's $222. The building I live in charges me $11 per month per air conditioner. And off he goes down the list of expenses that he has. And so I track Perry over the next year or so. He shows up multiple times, and he's really the only named character in this book. And I show what happens in his life. And it's not all bad, right? I mean, let's not be sentimental about this. Not everybody who has relatively little money wants more money, particularly. Many of those people are doing just fine. They love the work they do. They love their families. They love their churches. They do okay. And Perry's story, I think, is a story of hope throughout the book. And I hope readers will understand that in Broke, it's not just about feeling bad. It's really about sort of the changes that people make and how money affects their lives.
Talking to Dr. Michael Stein about his new book, Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. On the downside, though, Dr. Stein, a recurring theme is, I guess, that precariousness, where somebody who's used to living a middle-class lifestyle might say, oh, a $30 ticket for this, or, oh, $100 for books to go to community college, or a $200 car repair. You know, I don't love it. You don't love it, but you can pay it. It's an obstacle. It's a serious roadblock for a lot of the people who share their stories in your book.
Yeah. You know, small amounts of money are needed urgently are a problem for most Americans, right? About half of America has less than $400 in their savings account, which means when their carburetor breaks, they are in big trouble and other things have to shift around in their lives. That's really almost half of Americans don't have $400. So I think of poverty as really not just a sort of number or an income level or a Medicaid threshold or a policy target. I mean, poverty in the lives of my patients is really a feeling. And it's really a kind of pain, and it's inhabited by my patients many minutes of every day. And they talk about that in these conversations with me about how painful that is and the series of problems that arise. And it's more than pain, right? What pain does for any of your listeners who are in chronic pain of any kind, and I see poverty as this feeling of pain, is that it takes up space in your mind, right? And so that people with low income who are thinking about money have less room to think about all sorts of other things. And that's not only stressful, which produces its own bad outcomes, but it's like a tax on your thinking and reasoning. And if you have very little money, bad reasoning makes things even worse.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Angie is with us in Madison. Angie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Angie?
Sure. So I actually happen to be a physician at UW, but have been doing some elder care for my father over the last several months. And I think his story just like really exemplifies for me what some people have gone through. So he had been admitted to the hospital for a stroke and had been discharged with prescription to get a drug called Lovenox, which is a shot to thin your blood because that was what had caused his stroke. And he had gotten discharged and went to the pharmacy late at night to go pick it up. And he has Medicare, and the pharmacist said, oh yeah, you know, it didn't go through appropriately, so you're going to need to pay. It was for the whole prescription. It was going to be $1,000 for him to pay to get that medication. And, you know, he didn't like think of it going through, and we fortunately, you know, have credit cards and means to pay for it, and in the end we were able to get it all sorted out to have it pay the $10 copay that it really cost. But I think it highlighted for me as a physician, and I think for our family, you know, the true impact of wealth and money and access, you know, especially for older patients in our society.
Angie, thanks for that call. And Dr. Steiner, reading the stories of some of the patients in your book, they wouldn't have had maybe that credit card to get that medication they needed now. And they might not have had the connections, the internet connections even, to get the problem sorted out to get it down to that $10 copay.
Yeah, Angie, thanks for the call. There's so many parts to your story, right? First of all, it's that doctors, and I include myself here, really don't know the costs of the medications that we prescribe. That's number one. Number two is we have more than 20 million uninsured Americans, where every medical cost is a great burden. But we also have many insured Americans. We have who have problems paying their bills, right? So you could have a very good private insurance through your employer and have a very high deductible, and it's going to cost you a lot of money when you have to get that Lovenox shot. You have to pay the first $1,000 of that, right? Medicare patients, those who are over 65 or disabled, are people who are, again, not in many cases covered for the expenses of the medications. So we have a system that puts everybody at risk. As we know, medical costs are the leading cause of bankruptcy in people who've been hospitalized when they leave the hospital with those bills and outpatient charges. So I hear your story, Angie. There are a bunch of older folks who are talking my book about some of these things. And thanks for the call.
Thanks for calling in, Angie. We're talking to Dr. Michael Stein, physician and professor at Boston University. His new book is called Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts, maybe experiences with the difficulty of paying for healthcare, how has living in poverty, if you have, affected your well-being, mental and physical? If you work in healthcare yourself, what do you see when it comes to the financial well-being of your patients? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with physician Dr. Michael Stein. His new book is called Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences, questions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Lori is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Lori, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Lori?
Well, my question is, how is, and I'm not familiar with the book, but I'd be very interested in reading it. But my question is, how is the message of universal health care lost on the general public? I mean, I look at it like, okay, I pay $8,000 a year in health care. I don't utilize that much, right? I'm fortunate enough to, my family's fairly healthy, outside of any general things. But I don't know, how is it so lost? Is it because the general public doesn't understand the structure of payment, or doesn't understand that, hey, you are already kind of a slave, so to speak, to the insurance companies? You really don't have a free choice with some specialty care. You have to get it approved or maybe denied. And then there's the whole complexity of doctors practicing in hospitals that aren't covered under your insurance, but you're at the facility. So I look at it like, okay, I'm paying this $7,000 to $8,000 a year. I would rather pay that into a big bucket where I know that my elderly neighbor, even though I may not be using my insurance, my money may go to somebody who doesn't have it now, where we can, as a whole community, that would be covered and overall would make healthcare costs go down, because we would have a ultimately, hopefully, a healthier country, so to speak.
Gotcha. Lori, Dr. Stein, what do you think?
Lori, it's a very complicated question. You know, I'm absolutely in favor of every American having some coverage. We're, again, unique among our partners, our peer nations of higher income peer nations throughout Europe and the rest of the world, in that we don't, that we have tens of millions of people who are uncovered. Now, we have an extremely complicated healthcare payment system at this point. And the question then becomes a political one, if you believe in the moral one, right? The moral one being that healthcare is a right, and it's going to come for us. A medical problem is going to come for all of us someday. And so if you believe it's a right, then we need to either have some anger that we're not covering many people, or some shame that we're not covering many people, including ourselves, often those of us with insurance, that we need to, again, make the political decision. And there are lots of potential ways to get to universal coverage. But it's a political decision. I'm 100% with you. And the clearest evidence that insuring people who are uninsured helps is to look at the states that have expanded Medicaid over the past 10 years under the ACA. And what you see is that people in those states where it's been expanded, who never had insurance before, now have all sorts of health advantages and economic advantages in terms of, again, not being bankrupt, not being evicted, and all sorts of things that sort of flow down from being healthful. Because really, being healthy is a means to get to other pieces of your life. It's not only an end.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Michael Stein. His new book is called Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. Let's bring on another caller now. Kathy is with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for this program. I'm calling because I have adult children. My daughter is an engineer. She has top-tier insurance. She had a baby this past year during the pandemic. She, at 20 weeks, her doctor recommended that she have an ultrasound. It was recommended that, you know, went right in the back to do the ultrasound. There was no time for insurance to prior authorize it. Insurance didn't cover it, didn't cover that 20-week ultrasound. Consequently, my daughter was stuck with the $5,000 bill. She has very good insurance, and we fought with the insurance company, tooth and nail. They didn't budge one bit. So
Kathy,
it's not.
Oh, thanks a lot for the call. We don't have too much time left. Dr. Stein, so we're hearing this from people who are well-to-do and have good insurance. And now getting back to the patients in your book, Dr. Stein, I mean, if people with good insurance are getting hit with this kind of thing, what's happening to them?
Absolutely. I mean, the book is really, Broke is really meant to sort of capture the attention and stimulate the curiosity about what it's like to live with a low income and all the perils that ensue from that. But what your callers are saying again and again is that we have a healthcare system that's broken, right? That we spend several trillion dollars a year, about five times more than the next highest country. And we are, unable to cover all of the people in our country in terms of universal access to care. B, many people who are covered are still suffering. And C, we have poor health outcomes. We have low life expectancy. We have high infant mortality. We have a broken system. It's a very complicated system. It's one that needs to be fixed. But that's almost a parallel piece or a small piece of of my book, which is really about people who have no money and who happen to be seeing me in my office and talking about their more general money worries, not only their medical money worries.
We had one caller who mentioned, you know, family support can be a great thing for health, but the caller acknowledged not everybody has that. And that's a theme in your book. Often people are having to support their own family member, or they grew up with unreliable parents who couldn't support them as kids. A lot of people are just coming into adulthood with no support at all, again and again in your book.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you're talking about this sort of epidemic of isolation that that we're seeing in the United States, with so many people living alone, some by choice, some because they're homeless, some because they're evicted. We see that a lot. And again, when you have no money, you depend on lots of people. You depend on the resources of your community. You depend on the goodness of your neighbors. And Americans are actually quite generous, right? We have a very generous country, much more than other countries. We depend on our families or anybody who can really support us. That notion that I talked about of having less mental bandwidth because you're poor, because you're thinking about money all the time, really can be buffered by other people. And I think that health is clearly improved when you're able to find another person who you're accountable to and who can help you during stressful times.
Dr. Stein, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
Dr. Michael Stein is a primary care physician and professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at Boston University's School of Public Health. We talked to him about his new book, Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, state lawmakers are putting out plans for COVID-19 legislation in Wisconsin. We'll find out what's on the table, the roadblocks in the way for various plans, and we'll ask what you want to see happen. 2001 could be a big year in space with lots of efforts to launch missions, experiments, and more. We'll survey the upcoming year in spaceflight and what to watch for. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll dig into some tasty casseroles, perfect for the heart of the winter season. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Here's some lighter news in the midst of the serious stuff. A new article in the Huffington Post tracked down the baby names of 2020 that drew from states and state capitals. They went through public data that the Social Security Administration releases. They share just the first names that were filed five or more times last year for newborns. The number one state name was Dakota, with over 1,200 girls, almost 1,000 boys. Of course, that covers two states. And it doesn't look like anyone went all out and named their kids North Dakota or South Dakota. Georgia was also big with over 1,400 all girls. At the lower end, there are a handful of Alabamas, Utahs, Texases, Louisianas, Washingtons, and Californias, all under the 20 kids mark. Wisconsin? Nope, not on the list. So that is still up for grabs if you're looking for a unique name for a child this year. But we do better in the state capital department. Madison is the third most common state capital name for kids in 2020 after Lincoln and Jackson. Over 6,000 baby Madisons out there, mostly girls, just over 30 boys. And I'm pretty sure that every single one of those parents selected the name Madison as a tribute to this great state of Wisconsin. I cannot back that statement up in any way. But if you name your baby Wisconsin this year, be sure to let us know about it. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.